This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank, focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
One word, four letters, sounds like steel. Anyone? Here's a hint. You can't turn around on Wall Street without hearing about one of them. No cheating now. All right, here you go. All deals, all the time. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's the 16th of July today. It's a Monday. Good to have you with us. I'm just going to rattle off a list here to give you some idea of the kinds of deals that were being done in the global economy today. Early this morning, you might have heard IHOP's going to buy the bar and grill chain Applebee's. $1.9 billion is the tab there. Houghton Mifflin, the book company, is going to buy Harcourt for $4 billion. The Royal Bank of Scotland sweetening up its bid for the Dutch bank ABN AMRO, almost $100 billion there. So clearly, there's no shortage of corporate optimism because companies don't spend that kind of money unless they think they're going to make more money. And as second quarter earnings season gets into high swing this week, there's every sign that's exactly what's going to happen. Despite some recent struggles, Mattel has proven that playing with dolls can indeed turn a profit. The biggest U.S. toy maker announced results today. Sales rose about 7%, pretty much in line with what analysts were expecting. But Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports the success is coming from a place you might not expect.
Business has been better for Mattel outside the country than here at home. Sales for Barbie in the U.S. are down about 5%.
Worldwide gross sales for Barbie were up 6%.
That's Eric Kolb, equity analyst at Standard & Poor's. He says strong global sales and a favorable currency exchange rate have compensated for weak U.S. sales.
Domestic sales were down 3%, but that was more than offset by an 18% increase in international markets.
Those international sales are expected to remain strong in the months ahead. Sean McGowan with Wedbush Morgan Securities anticipates a good year for Mattel, but he cautions that here in the U.S., Barbie is finally facing some stiff competition.
Its principal competitor now is a company called MGA that makes Bratz. Bratz is in some countries actually bigger than Barbie. In this country, it's not yet. But it's the most serious competitive threat that Barbie has faced in its almost 50-year life.
There's also new competition from inside the Mattel family. Later this summer, the company is rolling out new characters for its high-end line of dolls sold under the American Girls brand. Overall, analysts expect the entire industry will do well as it heads into the second half and the crucial holiday season. The biggest winner is expected to be Mattel's main competitor. Analysts say Hasbro is on track for a banner year as it capitalizes on toys tied to summer blockbusters, Spider-Man, and the Transformers. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Investors like the Mattel news today, no matter where the profits were coming from, shares up 2.5% at the end of the day. French President Nicolas Sarkozy and German Chancellor Angela Merkel met today in Toulouse, down in southern France. Not coincidentally, that's where Airbus is headquartered. The two leaders were there to set their seal of approval on the latest shakeup at Airbus and at its parent company, EADS. The European plane maker has been struggling to perform under a cumbersome management setup, one that's handed a big competitive advantage to rival Boeing. From the Marketplace European desk in London, Stephen Beard reports.
The deal agreed today has been hailed historic for EADS, the defence giant, which is Airbus's parent company, although on the face of it, it may not sound like much of a breakthrough.
Today, the milestone that we have reached is that they have managed to reach agreement on there being one chairman and one chief executive.
But that, says Kevin Doan of the Financial Times, is a huge improvement on the status quo. Currently, EADS has two chairmen, one French and one German, and two chief executives, one from each country. A recipe for disaster, and so it's proved.
Duplication and difficult decision-making, and therefore always setting the scene that when there were difficulties in the company, that really has caused almost a paralysis of management.
The dual Franco-German leadership was designed to ensure that both countries retained a say in a vital strategic asset, a defence and aerospace corporation which employs tens of thousands of people. But, says Kieran Daly of Air Transport Intelligence, it's been totally counterproductive.
The result of that is we've seen the Airbus lagging very badly behind Boeing in the development of new aircraft, in sales of current aircraft, and for a long time, of course, in getting the A380 on track.
Airbus has been bogged down with the A380, the super jumbo. It's 2 years behind schedule and billions of dollars over budget. Boeing, meanwhile, has produced the highly successful 787 Dreamliner. The new management structure agreed today should reduce but not eliminate the Franco-German friction. After all, the new sole chairman of EADS will be German, while the sole chief executive will be French. But, says analyst Howard Wealdon, it's a start.
I think Airbus is on the road back, but there's a long way to go yet. Until we have got politics totally out of the equation, we cannot be satisfied that it can match Boeing like for like.
French President Nicolas Sarkozy hailed today's agreement as a victory for EADS and Airbus, but Boeing seems likely to soar above its troubled rival for some while to come. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Gasoline prices are on the rise, as I'm sure you've seen, and that's had a near universal impact. Because even if you don't drive or take the bus, chances are you use products that are transported, everything from household goods to food. And no matter who you are or where you live, you got to eat. Now, some of the most vulnerable people on the globe are feeling the impact of pricier food. The World Food Program, or WFP, says it's going to be harder to feed the world's hungry on its budget. But the group's blaming more than just gas prices. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WGBH, Helen Palmer has more.
As many as 850 million people go hungry worldwide. The World Food Programme feeds about 90 million of them. Its $2.7 billion budget won't stretch any further. But it may feed fewer in the future because of rising food prices, says the WFP's Greg Barrow.
One big factor is the growth in the economies in China and India, economies that are now consuming vast amounts of food on the global marketplace.
Barrow says the diversion of food crops to biofuels is another factor that's putting the WFP in a tight corner, and the world should take note. Nancy Childs agrees. She's a professor of food marketing at St. Joseph's University.
We have to look at the real cost of developing biofuels and the sustainability of the fuels. But more importantly, there's the opportunity cost that this acreage is not going to food crops.
That can make food even more expensive. Childs also points out that we're at a time of major change in the food production chain, as more people move to cities and have to buy food instead of growing it themselves. On top of that, global warming could cut food production in some areas. Mark Cohen of the International Food Policy Research Institute says what's really needed is a better global method to feed the hungry.
But I think there needs to be a more structural long-term response as well, so that humanitarian assistance is not in this hat-in-hand mode.
But Cohen sees a silver lining to biofuels. Maybe farmers in the developing world could get in on that boom. Indeed, even rising food prices may have a benefit, says Cohen, because they can help small farmers earn a living. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
One more oil item before we move on today. Crude closed at $74.15 a barrel in New York. That's up about 22 cents. Pricey enough, but perhaps a bargain by this fall. Analysts at Goldman Sachs said today they figure oil could hit $90 by late autumn. That's $90, unless OPEC backs off its production cuts. And that is not something that the cartel has been talking about doing. The headline number on Wall Street was a big one, 14, followed by three zeros. But the truth of the trading was a bit more complicated. Twice as many stocks fell today as rose. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Dow Industrials closed the day at their umpteenth record high of the year, nudging up against the 14,000 mark, as I mentioned. Given the way things have been going on Wall Street the past few sessions, you'd be forgiven for thinking the good times are here again. They may well be, but not everybody believes that, specifically investors in what are called the options markets, where there are some signs Wall Street's gone a little too far, a little too fast. We got economist Mark Zandi from MoodysEconomy.com on the line to explain exactly what that means. Mark, good to talk with you.
It's good to be with you.
Let's make sure everybody knows exactly what we're talking about. What are these option indexes here?
These are options to purchase the S&P 500 index or sell the S&P 500 index. It's really a bet on whether the market's going to rise or fall in the future.
And the numbers we were seeing this morning predicting a drop of 5%, 10%, as much as 19% in the S&P 500 in the next 6 months or so. How does that strike you?
Well, you know, 5%, 10% decline is in the realm of historical experience. That's a garden variety kind of correction. And we haven't had one of those in quite some time. So if you told me that there was going to be a correction like that in the next 3, 6, 9 months, I don't think I'd be too surprised. Now, 19%, that's serious stuff. But 5-10%, that's pretty standard.
All right, but let me run this one by you. I mean, we have been weathering in the stock market now the subprime fallout, private equity piling up loads of debt that it may or may not be able to pay back, rising bond yields. Is there something you think that might trigger this fall?
Well, the market does seem a bit extended. Credit spreads are incredibly narrow by historical standards. Investors are taking lots of risk.
Define that term for us, credit spreads.
Yes, good point. If you look in the bond market and look at yields on risky bonds, like junk bonds or subprime bonds, well, not subprime bonds now, but junk bonds, emerging debt, the yields are very thin relative to risk-free interest rates on treasury bonds, for example. And that, what that means is that investors aren't asking for too much compensation for all the risk that they're taking. And that compensation that now is incredibly narrow by historical standards.
Okay, so what other triggers might be out there in the market that we might look at?
Well, given this lack of concern about risk, any kind of risk that does appear is likely to spook investors. Obviously, the most pressing potential risk is what's going on in the housing and subprime mortgage market. That's still unraveling. I think mortgage quality will continue to weaken right through this year into next. So that's a problem that's still yet to play out.
Let's just chat real briefly about one of the other things that people talk about when they talk about the markets, fundamentals. I mean, how do you feel now about some of the things underlying the market that may or may not influence the way it goes?
Well, I think the fundamentals are okay. The economy is expanding. We're almost 6 years into an economic expansion. And I think what's driven the market in the last few days, couple of weeks, is the relief that the economy is going to be able to digest the housing downturn and the mortgage market mess without falling into recession. I think there was a lot of concern about that. There's been a lot of stress, but I think people, investors, are coming to the realization that this economy is resilient and it's going to make its way through without unraveling.
Mark Zandi is the chief economist at MoodysEconomy.com. Mark, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
There's been much wailing and gnashing of teeth lately over the continued misfortunes of the U.S. housing market. But of course, it's not just one market in this country. Some places real estate's down, some places it's up. And one of the up places is Seattle, where the population continues to boom and housing prices are firm. The Urban Land Institute calls Seattle a global gateway in a league with cities like New York, Washington, D.C., and San Francisco, which might be why 12 measly acres near the Space Needle are getting so much attention. Kathy Duchamp from KUOW has the story.
Right now, you can walk from one end of downtown Seattle to the other in less than an hour. The sidewalks roll up at about 10. But Seattle will stay open all night if Al Kleiss gets his way. He's looking to sell a patch of land that's now mostly parking lots.
I see a complete new neighborhood of high-rise, dense construction that will accommodate everything that a city ought to have. I don't see parking lots.
Kleiss is head of an old Seattle family that owns what many consider a missing link in the city's growth, 12 acres in the shape of a triangle on the northern edge of downtown. It's land his grandfather started to acquire during the Depression. Today, it will accommodate up to 14 million square feet of office and living space. That's comparable to what's now in downtown Baltimore. There's no list price, but observers say a developer would probably pay around $200 million.
we are going to present this as a completely unique opportunity that doesn't exist perhaps anywhere in the world, in any other urban center that is poised like a city like Seattle is poised.
Poised. That's a word a lot of people are using to describe why Seattle is such a hot development market. Local real estate economist Matthew Gardner.
From an economic basis, we're certainly more diversified than we used to be.
Seattle now has a deep bench of corporate giants. Amazon, Starbucks, Microsoft, Washington Mutual, Costco.
Rental rates have increased exponentially. We're seeing vacancy rates in Class A office space below 10%. All these things combined, when you look at these institutional investors and where they're looking to place money, they're looking at Seattle now not as somewhere which is relatively proximate to Alaska, but as somewhere that's become a first-tier market.
Seattle has also lifted the lid on how tall downtown buildings can be. High-rise office, condo, and apartment buildings can soar up to 500 feet on the Kleiss property. The idea is to concentrate growth downtown in order to combat sprawl. Who would be against that?
It's an unmanageable level of growth they want to accommodate in this tiny area of downtown.
John Fox is a low-income housing activist in Seattle. He says real estate developers exaggerate the amount of housing they'll build for the new office workers. Plus, he says, most workers won't want to live downtown anyway.
It's a combination of things. They can't afford to, or they make a lifestyle choice to live in the suburbs in a French-style chateau and live farther and farther out from the downtown to have the wide open spaces. And they're willing to put up with enormously long commutes.
Many as long as an hour. The companies who bid on the Kleiss property probably won't care about that. Rumors are that the deal will get a lot of attention from deep-pocketed real estate investment firms, probably from overseas. After all, whoever buys it should be prepared to spend $7 billion to build the property out. A lot of money in a city that was in a major recession just a few years ago. Ask Greg Johnson, president of the Seattle chapter of the Urban Land Institute.
Well, I moved here in 2001 from the Bay Area, shortly after an earthquake had hit this region. And I think the moving van was pulling into our driveway the same day they were announcing that Boeing was moving its headquarters to Chicago. The dot-com bubble was clearly bursting, and things were not looking too good. And there were some discussions around the dinner table. Have we made the right move, Greg?
But Johnson says Seattle rides the down cycles well. He says whoever can afford the Kleiss family jewel will get a gem. In Seattle, I'm Kathy Duchamp for Marketplace.
Coming up, finding affordable housing near Disneyland is no day in the park.
What this issue comes down to is that 5% of our land here in Anaheim generates 50% of our revenue to our general fund.
But first, let's do the numbers. It was the best of times and the of times on Wall Street. Today on the bright side, solid corporate earnings pushed the Dow Industrials within striking distance of the 14,000 mark. The blue chips ended up 43 points, 0.3% to close at 13,950. On the other side, investors are worried that subprime lending woes will bleed into the rest of the economy. The NASDAQ slipped 9 points, 0.3% to finish the day at 2697. The S&P 500 sagged 3 points, about 0.2% to end at 1549. A spoonful of syrup sure helps a corporate deal go down. Pancake Shrine IHOP gobbled up Applebee's for $2 billion. Investors were hungry for seconds today. Applebee's plumped up more than 2%. IHOP stacked up nearly 8.9%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. And by American Public Media's weekly program, Speaking of Faith. Starting July 19th, Krista Tippett explores the ethics of eating with author Barbara Kingsolver, speakingoffaith.org. Ever hear a song on Marketplace, but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to an online store where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on the Producer Price Index for June. President Bush and United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon meet at the White House. And the House Foreign Affairs Committee discusses policy options in Iraq. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. There is probably not a book out there that's going to compete with the last installment of Harry Potter when it comes out just after midnight Saturday morning. But for those who do have some time to spare for a little light reading this summer, Sandra Tsing Lo has a recommendation in this edition of The Lowdown.
Recently, a friend gave me a hot new beach read, The Manny. It's about a stressed Manhattan mom who hires not a third-world female nanny for domestic help, but that latest must-have accessory of Upper East Side families, the white male nanny, or Manny, who in this case is young and buff and apparently does more than dust. Sadly, though, it's not quite the escapist fantasy I like for the beach, because I already have a Manny. Oh, yeah. He runs our household, and I can have at him anytime. He is my husband. Unlike the handsome but mysterious and constantly traveling zillionaire investment bankers necessary to the genre of chick and now mom lit, my husband is a musician, he is quite often home, and he's extremely unmysterious. Knives up in the dishwasher, he'll say, bending over, not very saucily, and wears the French maid's outfit to correct my error. Another of my personal valet's favorite sayings is, "Shall I pack that for you?" But note the passive-aggressive tone you don't get from the better hired male help. It turns out my Manny believes I'm a horrible packer of food, clothes, toys, and minivans, spatially dyslexic. So he patrols the house, continually repacking bigger things into smaller things. I think he was a squirrel or beaver in a former life, not able to find anything anymore, not to mention that all the important pots have been put away a foot higher than I can reach. Such a pity. I've moved into a state of learned helplessness, where after almost 20 years of cohabitation, my husband does the shopping, cooking, dishes, and laundry. I do the bills. It's hard. My Manny is also an eco-Manny. To save the environment, he believes clothes should always be line-dried, all over the backyard, even when we're having company. Look at those underpants flapping. It's not quite like dining al fresco on the Upper East Side, but how glamorous to enjoy the same quality of domestic assistance. Good white help is hard to find. Not so much, as long as you don't mind knives up.
Sandra Tsing Lo and her Manny live right here in Los Angeles. Send us your comments when you get a minute. Go to marketplace.org, click on that link that says contact. If your vacation plans this summer include a trip to a theme park, take a second between rides to have a look at the people who work there. It's their job to make you happy, so you might not pick up on any discontent they might be feeling. At the granddaddy of American theme parks, though, some workers are feeling down because Disney's not making them welcome in the company's own neighborhood. Jordan Davis reports.
Thirteen-year-old Damien loves playing trumpet. He practices for hours a day. Sometimes, though, his older brother wants some quiet time.
He tells me to not play that much. And my mom, like, she tells me to play softly.
They'd love to tell him to go to his room, but he doesn't have one. The Gomez family, who asked that we not use their real name, lives in a one-bedroom apartment. Mom and dad in the bedroom, the teenage brothers on a bunk bed in the living room. And there's a pair of cockatiels, too.
Are there other places where you can practice?
Like one time in the closet.
You practiced in the closet before?
Yeah. My parents were kind of sleeping, and my dad, he was working and stuff, so I had to play in there.
In high-priced Orange County, lots of people are priced out of suitable apartments. By some measures, you need to make $25 an hour to afford a two-bedroom in Anaheim. Damian Gomez's dad, Miguel, makes far less bussing tables at the Disneyland Resort.
I would like to live in a house with three bedrooms in a yard so my kids can be more comfortable, so we can feel like we have enough money. But with what you make at Disneyland, sometimes I don't even have enough money to pay rent. So I feel very frustrated.
Miguel Gomez is even more frustrated by Disney. A developer called SunCal wants to build 2,000 apartment units near Disneyland, 250 of them reserved for lower-income families like the Gomez's. Disney is pushing a ballot measure opposing it. Its reasoning goes like this. If people are living in the resort district, the atmosphere there will be, well, less like a vacation, and that might be bad for business. Anaheim and Disney have spent a lot of money spiffing up what used to be kind of a seedy area. Visitors sporting their mouse ears are much more likely to stick around than they were before.
Go ahead and keep your hands down.
Disney pays parrot handlers to entertain the tourist crowds in one shopping complex. Todd Ament is the head of the Anaheim Chamber of Commerce. He says the resort area is a cash cow for the city.
What this issue comes down to is that 5% of our land here in Anaheim generates 50% of our revenue to our general fund.
In other words, Disney wields a lot of clout in Anaheim. But the SunCal developer is planning to fight back with its own ballot measure, one that would make it harder for Disney to expand its theme parks. Councilmember Lori Galloway says the issue touches a nerve with a lot of people.
The city of Anaheim is a very tourist-driven city, and there are so many service sector employees who are the fuel that fires that economic engine.
And so many of them have a tough time finding housing. Even if all 250 low-priced apartments are built in the SunCal project, thousands more like them are needed. That means Damian Gomez will probably be rehearsing in cramped quarters for the foreseeable future. I'm Jordan Davis for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
These final notes, you know, video games have come a long way since the days of Pong and Super Mario Brothers. Now, Electronic Arts is taking the evolution one step further. The company's newest online sports offering will include actual weather in the city where your virtual game is being played. NCAA Football 2008 is going to coordinate a live feed with the Weather Channel. From the weather now to one of the world's great commercial mysteries, airline pricing. And you know what we're talking about. Turn your back for just a second, and the sticker price on a ticket has gone from a couple of $100 to $800 or more. Turns out you're not just unlucky, you're a victim of one of the most complex pricing markets yet devised by man. A software company founder and an MIT graduate, we should add, decided to study the puzzle, and he discovered the same thing we all have, that finding the cheapest airfare between two cities is, in his words, mathematically unsolvable. The single American Airlines flight he studied from Boston to San Francisco generated 25 million pricing possibilities. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media on this Monday. Today, the Dow rose 43 points, 0.3%, not quite to the 14,000 mark there. The Nasdaq fell 9 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 dropped 3 points. That's about 0.2% there. Our producers include Megan Larson, Caitlin Carroll, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time, reading the fine print on kids' snacks.
Sugar, artificial colors. Sugar, sugar, artificial colors.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.